ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Thank you so much, Kashyapa Prabhu. Mutual admiration. Kashyapa Prabhu always takes whatever ideas are there and then makes them better and perfects them. So I always like to come back and see what an idea perfected looks like or improved upon. And also, I'm thrilled to be here because of you, the audience. It's a rarefied audience. First of all, those who even know what Bhagavad Gita is in the world are rare. What most people, when we show them Srimad Bhagavatam, they say, "Oh, Bhagavad Gita." And we say, "No, it's not the Bhagavad Gita. It's the Srimad Bhagavatam." And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's had several tenets for his philosophy, and one of them is that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the peerless authority on all matters, and it's called the spotless Purana. Those who appreciate Bhagavatam are of the same category. So I'm, you know, coming into this room, I feel the presence of an august assembly, and deeply appreciating that your attachment to the Bhagavatam so much that you come here on a Sunday to hear for several hours. So thank you very much for having me. And we'll begin with a Mangalacharan, which is important in matters of discussing Shastra, because there's the means of approach is as important as the actual hearing and chanting. Entering into the process of hearing and chanting with humility, and also remembering the context that we're receiving a gift that's coming from above and it's being passed down to us. So the verses that you've been reciting here embody that idea and also describe how it's in some way it's benefits-based marketing to understand what am I going to get out of this? As living entities, that's part of our nature to ask that question about everything. Ultimately, I'm filtering out all those things in my life from minute to minute based on what's in it for me. And when I perceive that there's nothing in it for me, then I drop that and I move to something else. That's just what we do. And reminding ourselves before starting a process of hearing and chanting of what is this? What's going to happen if I stick with the process? Is a means of focusing the mind and bringing us to a point of enthusiasm for hearing the matter. And there is a way to hear with enthusiasm. And that kind of hearing is especially effective when we're leaning into it, when we're eager to hear, and when we're assimilating it as we hear it, then it becomes even more potent. So we'll chant these verses together, is it? Is that your normal process? Okay. So we start off, this is the first verse, and we'll just go through the progression as you're used to. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Janmadyasa Yaton Vayaditaratashcharte Shvabhigna Swara Tene Brahma Ridaya Adi Kavaye Huhyanti Yatsurayaha Tejopari Vidam Chita Vinyamayo Tri Gargo Mrisha Dhamna Swena Sadani Rasta Kuakam Satyam Param Ti Mahi. Personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, sustenance and destruction of the manifested universes. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representations of water seen in fire or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universes temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature appear factual, although they are unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, which is forever free of the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. Dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satyam bejam vasta mamatra vastu shivadam tapalam trimulanam Srimad Bhagavate Mahamune Krite Kimba Prayerishvaraha Sadhya Vidya Varudyate Prakriti Bishushu Shubhis Takshanat. Completely rejecting all religious activities which are materially motivated, this Bhagavat Purana propounds the highest truth, which is understandable by those devotees who are fully pure in heart. The highest truth is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Such truth uproots the threefold miseries. This beautiful Bhagavatam, compiled by the great sage Vyasadeva in his maturity, is sufficient in itself for God realization. What is the need of any other scripture? As soon as one attentively and submissively hears the message of Bhagavatam, by this culture of knowledge, the Supreme Lord is established in his heart. Nigama kalpataror kalitam balam shukamukadamrita dravasamyutam pipata bhagavatam rasamalayam mahoraho sikha bhuvi bhavukaha. O expert and thoughtful men, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literatures. It emanated from the lips of Sri Shukadeva Goswami. Therefore, this fruit has become even more tasteful, although its nectarian juice was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. Shushusho shadadhanasya vasudeva katarachi syan mahatsevaya vipra punyatirta nishevanat. O twice-born sages, by serving those devotees who are completely freed from all vice, great service is done. By such service, one gains affinity for hearing the messages of Vasudeva. Shrinvatam sukhata krishna punya shravana kirtana prityantaksto hyapadrani vidunoti suritsatam. Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma Supersoul in everyone's heart and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who relishes his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. Nashta praeshu bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati utama shloke bhaktir bhavati naishtaki. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam and by rendering of service to the pure devotee, all that is troubled to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service under the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. Tada rajas tamo bhava kama lobha dayaschaye cheta eter anavidham sthitam sattve prasidati. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's modes of passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. Eva prasanna manaso bhagavat bhakti yogataha bhagavat tattva vijnanam mukta sangasya jayate. Thus established in the mode of unalloyed goodness, the man whose mind has been enlivened by contact with devotional service to the Lord gains positive scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead in the stage of liberation from all material association. Vidyate rare granthish chijante sarva samshaya Shiyante chasya karmani drishtaiva manishvare. Thus the knot in the heart is pierced, and all misgivings are cut to pieces. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated when one sees the self as master. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we're continuing our reading of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We're now in Canto 6, Chapter 1, The History of the Life of Vajamil. Text number 37. Translation for this verse. Shukadeva Goswami continued, being thus addressed by the messengers of Yamaraj, the servants of Vasudeva smiled and spoke the following words in voices as deep as the sound of rumbling clouds. Purport. The Yamadutas were surprised to see that the Vishnudutas, although polite, were hindering the rule of Yamaraj. Similarly, the Vishnudutas were also surprised that the Yamadutas, although claiming to be servants of Yamaraj, the supreme judge of religious principles, were unaware of the principles of religious action. Thus, the Vishnudutas smiled, thinking, what is this nonsense they are speaking? If they are actually servants of Yamaraj, they should know that Ajamil is not a suitable candidate for them to carry off. Text number 38. The blessed messengers of Lord Vishnu, the Vishnudutas, said, if you are actually servants of Yamaraj, you must explain to us the meaning of religious principles and the symptoms of irreligion. Purport. This inquiry by the Vishnudutas to the Yamadutas is most important. A servant must know the instructions of his master. The servants of Yamaraj claim to be carrying out his orders, and therefore the Vishnudutas very intelligently ask them to explain the symptoms of religious and irreligious principles. A Vaishnav knows these principles perfectly well, because he is well acquainted with the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord says, Sarvadharman pratyaja mam ekam sharanam braja. Give up all other varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. Therefore, surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the actual principle of religion. Those who have surrendered to the principles of material nature instead of to Krishna are all impious, regardless of their material position. Unaware of the principles of religion, they do not surrender to Krishna, and therefore they are considered sinful rascals, the lowest of men, and fools bereft of all knowledge. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 7:15, Namam Dushkritunu Mudha, everyone can say together, Namam Dushkritunu Mudha, Prapadyante Naradama, Mayaya Pritagyana, Asuram Bhava Mashritaha. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish, lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. One who has not surrendered to Krishna does not know the true principle of religion. Otherwise, he would have surrendered. I'll read that again. It's very nice. One who has not surrendered to Krishna does not know the true principle of religion. Otherwise, he would have surrendered. The question posed by the Vishnudutas was very suitable. One who represents someone else must fully know that person's mission. The devotees in the Krishna consciousness movement must therefore be fully aware of the mission of Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. Otherwise, they will be considered foolish. All devotees, especially preachers, must know the philosophy of Krishna consciousness so as not to be embarrassed and insulted when they preach. Let's discuss these last two verses and purports just to see if we can take some lessons from them. One is that although the Vishnudutas and the Yamadutas are ultimately servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they're working in different capacities. And there's a way in which there are various layers of knowledge. And it may appear, or rather than say layers, I would say there's a hierarchy of knowledge. And although it's in the same system, when one's looking at one level of the hierarchy, one might then think that it's a different knowledge altogether. However, there's a unity in this knowledge, except that those who have the perspective of Krishna consciousness can see comprehensively what the hierarchy is and understand that there is information that's more important and information that's less important as it relates to either the material world or the spiritual world. As in, as an example in the of this principle in the Sri Ishapanishad, it is mentioned anyad eva hur sambhavad, anyad ahura sambhavad, iti shushumadhiranam yenas tadvich chakshire. That one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and another result is obtained by worshipping that which is not supreme. It seems like a simple statement, but it does save one a lot of trouble in one's life. Because if I mistake one for the other, then I have to live with the result, especially if I'm a human, because humans are supposed to get to know their environment a little better than animals and make good choices. So here, there's a very classic way in which two well-meaning groups of people come together with a knowledge that is, in their minds, both of them have knowledge, and then they're at odds with one another. Has this ever happened to any of you? Well, I'll take that as a tacit yes. It's altogether possible to have what you consider to be the best of all knowledge and then meet somebody else who has knowledge as well and then be at odds. And one thing that's instructive about this whole episode is that there's a way in which they talk about it and they come to a conclusion. I don't think that the Yamadutas at the end are, you know, completely happy about it at first. They have a little something to get over when they discover that they didn't have the ultimate information. But nonetheless, they went through the process and they were careful to talk about it. That's one lesson. Don't assume that just because somebody has a different kind of knowledge or an outlook that you can't come to some consensus by looking in a more comprehensive way at the knowledge system itself and seeing where the commonalities are and the differences as well and agreeing upon the differences. Another point here is I like the expertise of the Vishnudutas, because in the way of communication, it's very helpful to not only ask questions, but specific questions. Questions are the answer, I like to say, the answer to good and clear communication. In India, when the Western devotees first came with Prabhupada, they were confronted by many people who would ask them, what do you think of this Swami, what do you think of that Swami? Because they're obviously in India, the land of Swamis and teachers and acharyas and so forth. People have various ways of practicing spiritual life, and they would like to know, they wanted to know from the representatives of Prabhupada, you know, what do you think of this person? And so, not knowing exactly how to deal with all this and not knowing all these various Swamis, the devotees came back to Prabhupada and said, well, they're asking, what about this Swami, what about that Swami? And Prabhupada taught them an important principle, and that was, don't assail the person, but I wouldn't use the word assail, but ask about what is his or her philosophy. In other words, don't give ad hominem responses and look at the character of the particular person, but the best way to find out how to answer somebody who asked that kind of question is to ask them, Prabhupada said, what is his philosophy? instead of asking about the person himself or commenting about the person, say, well, what does he say? And then to compare the philosophy to the Bhagavad Gita and say, how does it match up? How does it harmonize with the Bhagavad Gita? And so this appears to be what the Vishnudutas are doing here, is asking this question. Can you explain yourselves? The Vishnudutas are asking the question. Okay, explain yourself. What's your philosophy? Tell us what you're thinking. And now the Vishnudutas are going to have to explain what's going on. And now, before I move on, and just to get a feel for how we're all feeling today and working together, let's take any reflections you have or a question that you think will bring out more from the verses or the purports. A reflection is anything that you heard from the verses or the purport that I read or any of the monologue so far that stuck in your mind, that sounded usable, interesting, notable in any way, and you can just put it back out so it gets amplified in the assembly, or if you have a question. But let's do reflections for now. Just reflect back and say anything that you heard so far that stuck in your mind.
Here's the microphone coming.
Oh. Didn't expect the microphone. Thank you. I'm coming from a Christian background, very heavily Christian parents. They're concerned about me following this way instead of Christianity. And so this resonated with me because I identify them with the servants of Yamaraj, and then they mean well, and they're also.
She means that in the best possible way.
In the best possible way. I actually don't know the story behind this, so there's some insult meant with that. I don't intend it. they believe the Bible, and they believe that it is the way to achieve God, and they also. They're well-meaning, and they're also mirroring what's said in the Gita. They just don't read the Gita, so that's what my reflection is.
That's nice. That's a contemporary example, one that we can really relate to, and it's important to relate Shastra to our own lives and see how do we deal with these kinds of situations, because one of the ways in which we advance in spiritual life is by deliberation. We have to compare one thing to another and come to what's called a siddhanta. A siddhanta means not just what something is, but also what it isn't. Siddhanta bolichita nakara alash iha hoite krishna lage sudridmanash. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Kaviraj Goswami says that don't be lazy. Don't be alash. It means don't hesitate to look at and compare various philosophies and see who says what to whom, how do the different philosophies compare, what are the categories of knowledge and so forth. He says, because by doing so, you can come to a siddhanta or a clear understanding of what you're actually dealing with. Don't base your practice on sentimentality. Of course, there has to be emotion, but there also has to be philosophy where you're able to logically understand why one philosophy is superior to another. It makes more sense. It's more logical also. And when you have that, he says, then you have sudrid manash, which means your mind becomes very strongly fixed in the philosophy. So those who are beginners in Krishna consciousness are said to not have that sudrid manash. They have faith, but it's a kind of sentimental faith that, oh, I really like this, I like the people, but they don't know too much about the philosophy behind the practice itself. And therefore, someone can come along and say, you're kidding me, you're following that? That doesn't make any sense. Look what these guys wear, or whatever it is. And then, why'd they wear paint on their face? I mean, somebody asked. It's like, yeah, right, okay, maybe it doesn't. But if the next level of devotee, or the higher levels of devotees, especially the highest level of devotee, is very much acquainted with Shastra and has made all these comparisons and has had dialogue to, as Prabhupada used to say, discuss thoroughly, threadbare, the philosophy. And by doing so, one has this firm determination, because one knows what it is and what it isn't, and knows how to compare various philosophies to one another. What other reflections do you have? Things that came up? Yes, a lot of reflections. Microphone is just coming now.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I really liked questions are the answer. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, as I said in my seminar, whoever's asking the questions is leading the conversation. Oftentimes we think if we're telling, then we're, you know, making progress. But actually, based on human psychology and the way language works, when you ask questions, you're actually leading the conversation. And therefore, I often describe the question mark to be like a hook. If you look at it, it's a hook, and you know, you can pull in different directions, or you can also use it as a tennis racket. Because if somebody asks you a question you don't understand, don't try to answer it. Rather, answer a question with a question with the purpose of getting something that you can get your mind around, that you do know how to answer. For instance, if somebody asks you a question that's vague, and then you can ask, well, how do you mean that? Can you describe it a little more? And then they'll say something more specific. And then you can answer it with after having comprehended it like that. So you find throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's questions and answers. And the Bhagavad Gita also. Arjuna asks a question, and Krishna answers it. And sometimes Krishna will ask questions, and his devotees will answer. And back and forth, this is the way to draw out knowledge, is to ask questions. And it's something recommended throughout the Shastra that you should become expert at asking questions. It's not so easy to ask questions. Sometimes if you say, you have any questions? And everyone looks around like, I don't have any questions. And one result of having these kinds of sessions where we hear and chant together, just like we're at Naimasaranya, it's like that just now. All the sages sitting together, with one exception here. Then one of the great benefits of discussing thoroughly threadbare is you come away with more questions than you do answers. This is the great mystery of discussing Shastra. The deeper you go into it, the more valuable questions you have to ask. And then you become hungry. So now when you recognize a qualified person, for instance, you'll hear a class and then go like, that person really knows the Shastra, knows what they're talking about, has realization. Therefore, I want to ask now. And you have a valuable question ready. So Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, don't ask inane questions. Don't ask meaningless questions. Once in Japan, a new bhakta asked Prabhupada, have you ever met Indra? And Prabhupada said, what difference does it make to you if I've met him or not? And Trivik Ramaj was there and he said, Indra would be lucky if he met Prabhupada. But a refined mind, and by studying the Shastra constantly, you'll find that it gets deeper and deeper and more nuanced. And then you have better questions. And the better your questions are, and the more that you're eager to ask questions, the more absorbing will be your reading of Shastra. You'll be scouring the pages, where's the answer to my question? And when you find it, people see you dancing down the hallway and go, what happened? It's like, I found it. It's there. It's right there in Shastra. And that's what bolsters your spiritual life, to continually have those experiences through Shastra. Sharon, yes?
Yes, hello. So, as many of you know, I was blessed to bring to consciousness by my daughter. And I've been involved for a year and a half. And
hold that just a little closer for the people online.
So I've been involved for a year and a half, and
a little closer means it almost has to touch your chin.
When I'm surrounded by these beautiful, youthful 25, 26-year-olds, the first thing they ask me is, what is my opinion or my feeling? What was my feeling when I found out Stephanie was becoming involved in Krishna consciousness? And I say, I'm so grateful because she handed me the Bhagavad Gita, and she said, Mom, this book has all the answers you've been asking your whole life. So the first thing that the 26-year-old say to me, well, my parents, one said to me the other day, she goes, I go to bed at 8 o'clock, I wake up early, I read books, I meditate, I don't drink, I don't smoke, and my parents are worried about me. They're so lucky that you have those attributes. And then on the other hand, my parents are 88 and 87. And every time I'm driving home from the temple, I call them just to say hello, because in the car it can be a short conversation. And they go, where are you driving home from? And I go, I was meditating. And my mother says, you meditate a lot. So they're 88 and 87, and I still go to synagogue with them. But I don't know how to explain to them that I am Krishna conscious. And one of the statements on the screen was, know what to say to share about Krishna consciousness. So can you speak to how I can actually talk to the 26-year-olds and help them to reframe their parents' thinking? So their memory of Krishna consciousness isn't the airport version of giving out books from years ago, but to let them know that a friend of mine has that book from the Philadelphia airport. And he went there specifically to get it. He actually went to
I remember
the airport.
That guy.
He went there to get the book.
Hopefully he doesn't remember.
So can you share how these beautiful young devotees can, the simplest way they can share with their parents that what they're doing is a good thing? And how can I share with my 88-year-old father who owns a Bhagavad Gita and is reading it, and every time I see him he goes, I just don't get it. I'm like, it's okay.
Well,
it's in your house. That's a blessing.
One of the really good questions and helpful insights. Thank you, Sharon. One of the ways that one of the basic principles that I've developed for my own practice is there are certain categories of people that we don't try to give philosophy to. You know, parents and other kinds of loved ones, unless you have an extraordinary or very different kind of relationship with them, are not based on philosophy. They're based on love and culture. A family is like that. If you go and try to preach to your parents, they're not going to appreciate it at any time. Because, hey, I'm your parents. I'm your parent. It bounces right off. The best thing to do is to give love. Love them, appreciate them, show them how the philosophy has made your heart softer and more appreciative of who they are. After all, you know, you should have more gratitude for what they've done for you, raising you and so forth. And they may notice that because most children, by the time they're 16, start to push away from the nest. And they always keep, you know, a slight edge with them that, okay, you raised me, but now I'm on my own. But if someone becomes Krishna conscious, they may have the wherewithal to actually go back and embrace their parents in a deeper way. And the time will come, if one develops such a relationship, that the parent may be open to philosophy. That happened for me. My mother was a sociologist, a very intelligent person, and I had a loving relationship with her, but it didn't go into philosophy very much. Even if we talked about Krishna consciousness, it would be from a sociological, humanistic point of view. That's as far as she would allow. Until my father died, and a year later, she realized, after being married for 70 years, that she was a soul kind of beleaguered in a big ocean of the material world. And our relationship changed. And she then opened her heart, and we were no longer mother and son, but now she was an inquiring soul who realized that here was somebody who has been practicing and maybe had something to offer. So the Shastra recommends that we're careful about recognizing our relationships when trying to impart knowledge. How to get young people to do that? George Bernard Shaw said, it's too bad that youth is wasted on the young. But one of the great values of maturity is that you mature by making mistakes and so forth. But those who are intelligent young devotees, they can be advised that many of us, when we went away from home, you know, wrote rather caustic letters back to our parents saying, you know, like, hey, you should surrender too. And they really appreciated it. We'll take one more reflection. Yes.
So I'm paraphrasing. There was one sentence in there that says, those who seek to represent another must completely know their mission. Mm. And that really struck me that, you know, as practitioners of bhakti, we're walking around and people see us as representatives of Prabhupada, representatives of, you know, the Hare Krishna movement or, you know, whatever, or bhakti. And how deeply, you know, we must understand what it means to be a representative. So that sentence really leaped out at me.
Yes, that's a very important point from this lesson that we can take from this. There are two aspects of understanding philosophy. One is knowing what it says, and another is how to represent it, or we say represent it. In the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, fourth chapter, first verse in the purport, that's 141, purport, Prabhupada writes about what it means to be realized. So we'll read that because it's important and relative, and we can relate it to this. We'll start with the verse. Vyasadeva said, on hearing Suta Goswami speak thus, Shaunaka Muni, who was the elderly, learned leader of all the rishis, engaged in that prolonged sacrificial ceremony, congratulated Suta Goswami by addressing him as follows, Prabhupada's purport. In a meeting of learned men, when there are congratulations or addresses for the speaker, the qualifications of the congratulator should be as follows. He must be the leader of the house and an elderly man. He must be vastly learned also. Sri Shaunaka Rishi had all these qualifications, and thus he stood up to congratulate Sri Suta Goswami when he expressed his desire to present Srimad Bhagavatam exactly as he heard it from Shukdev Goswami, and also realized it personally. Personal realization, and this is the part I wanted to specifically bring into evidence here. Personal realization does not mean that one should, out of vanity, attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. This is called realization. So that's the pertinent part that I wanted to bring out, and that is that when we learn something from the guru, from the parampara, from the shastra, yes, we can bring it back out and present it, but it's also important that we've realized it in such a way that we can present it in a way that's relatable to the particular audience so they can understand it. And now I'm going to move on to the next verses. This is verse number 39. And the Vishnu Dutas are speaking to the Yamadutas. What is the process of punishing others? Who are the actual candidates for punishment? Are all karmis engaged in fruitive activities punishable, or only some of them? Purport. One who has the power to punish others should not punish everyone. There are innumerable living entities, the majority of whom are in the spiritual world and are nitya mukta, everlastingly liberated. There is no question of judging these liberated living beings. Only a small fraction of the living entities, perhaps 1/4, are in the material world. And the major portion of the living entities in the material world, eight million 400,000 of the 8 million of the 8,400,000 forms of life are lower than human beings. They are not punishable, for under the laws of material nature, they are automatically evolving. Human beings who are advanced in consciousness are responsible, but not all of them are punishable. Those who engage in advanced pious activities are beyond punishment. Only those who engage in sinful activities are punishable. Therefore, the Vishnudutas particularly inquired about who is punishable and why Yamaraj has been designated to discriminate between who is punishable and who is not. How is one to be judged? What is the basic principle of authority? These are the questions raised by the Vishnudutas. Really important questions. This scenario has come up here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the sixth canto. It's following the fifth canto. Fifth canto describes, in the fifth canto, Shukadev Goswami describes to Parikshit Maharaj the material universes and shows how there are higher planetary systems, middle and lower planetary systems. And then he described the adverse effects of sinful activities. When one performs sinful activities, one is degraded by the modes of material nature, jaganya guna vrittista, is dragged down into a lower, adoga chanti, means it's dragged lower into a realm, an atmosphere where there's punishment. So that punishment, really, it's important to understand, is for reformation. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense logically, or either that, or it makes the person who set up the system to be a monster. So it's meant for refinement. Nonetheless, as pointed out in the beginning of the sixth canto, which is poshana, the whole category of knowledge here is the protection of the Lord, how he's protecting the living entities. And Parikshit Maharaj, being the Vaishnav who is compassionate for all living entities, is really disturbed by hearing how so many living entities are suffering in adverse conditions of life. And therefore he asks the question, how will they be delivered? How can they be purified? And that's what brings this story to light, and why these why Shukadev Goswami is telling the story of Ajamil to indicate the ultimate way that living entities are freed from sinful activities in a comprehensive and complete way. And now to the next verse, which is 40. The Yamadutas replied, that which is prescribed in the Vedas constitutes dharma, the religious principles, and the opposite of that is irreligion. The Vedas are directly the Supreme Personality of God in Narayan and are self-born. This we have heard from Yamaraj. Purport, the servants of Yamaraj reply quite properly. They did not manufacture principles of religion or irreligion. Instead, they explained what they had heard from the authority, Yamaraj. Mahajano yena katha sapanta. Altogether. Mahajano yena katha sapanta. One should follow the Mahajan, the authorized person. Yamaraj is one of the 12 authorities. Therefore, the servants of Yamaraj, the Yamadutas, replied with perfect clarity when they said, Shushruma, we have heard. The members of modern civilization manufacture defective religious principles through speculative concoction. This is not dharma. They do not know what is dharma and what is adharma. Therefore, as stated in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, dharma projita kaitavotra. Dharma not supported by the Vedas is rejected from Srimad Bhagavata Dharma. Bhagavata Dharma comprises only that which is given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bhagavata Dharma is sarva dharman parityaja mamekam sharanam raja. One must accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender to him and whatever he says. That is dharma. Arjuna, for example, thinking that violence was adharma, was declining to fight, but Krishna urged him to fight. Arjuna abided by the orders of Krishna, and therefore he is actually a dharmi, because the order of Krishna is dharma. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Vedaishta sarver ahameva vedya. The real purpose of Veda, knowledge, is to know me. One who knows Krishna perfectly is Krishna. One who knows Krishna is perfectly liberated. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 4:9, janma karma cha me divyam evam yo vedi tatvata tyakva deham punarjanma naiti mameti sarjana. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. One who understands Krishna and abides by his order is a candidate for returning home back to Godhead. It may be concluded that dharma, religion, refers to that which is ordered in the Vedas, and adharma, irreligion, refers to that which is not supported in the Vedas. Dharma is not actually manufactured by Narayan. As stated in the Vedas, asya mahato bhutasya nishvasitam itad yad rigveda iti. The injunctions of dharma emanate from the breathing of Narayan, the supreme living entity. Narayan exists eternally and breathes eternally, and therefore dharma, the injunctions of Narayan, also exist eternally. Srila Madhvacharya, the original Acharya, for those who belong to the Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, says, Vedanam pratamo vakta harir eva yato vibhu ato vishvatmaka veda ityahur veda varina. The transcendental words of the Vedas emanated from the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the Vedic principles should be understood to be Vaishnava principles because Vishnu is the origin of the Vedas. The Vedas contain nothing besides the instructions of Vishnu, and one who follows the Vedic principles is a Vaishnav. The Vaishnav is not a member of a manufactured community of this material world. That's pretty powerful. The Vaishnav is not a member of a manufactured community of this material world. But, you know, this understanding of manufactured, creating a idea of, well, let me say on the positive side, oftentimes people ask this question, what is the difference between one religion or another? Or how do we, as a representative of the Gaudiya, Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, look at other traditions? And one way of answering that question that I've found that is appreciated by others is to talk about a gold standard. For instance, when we look at gold, we want to know what quality of gold it is. There's gold that's sold on the streets of Honolulu to tourists that must be about 13 carat, and it turns green after you swim in a swimming pool for a while. Got a little gold in there somewhere, but it doesn't act the same way as 24 carat gold does. 24 karat gold is untarnishable. And in a similar way, at the beginning of Bhagavatam, in the invocation prayers, we heard dharma projita kaitavo traparamo nirmat saranam satam, that what was going to be spoken in the Bhagavatam would be of the highest standard. In other words, they were saying, we're kicking out any of the other lower forms or the lower standards that are sometimes mentioned in the name of religion. And then, what is the gold standard given in the Bhagavatam? It's said in the second chapter, Savai Pumsa Paro Dharmo Yato Bhaktira Dhoksaje Haitukiya Pratiyata Yama Supersediti. And that is that whatever tradition you're practicing from should have these two qualities to meet the gold standard. One is that is unmotivated. In other words, service for service. You're not serving God for your own purposes. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that there are various motivations by which people act or serve. The lowest of all, he says, is fear. I do it because I'm afraid of the consequences. The next above it, he said, is prospect, that what I'm going to get in return. Above that, he said, is his duty. I'm doing it because of my duty. And then the highest motivation is out of love. And the standard of the Bhagavatam is this natural, pure love, developing that for Krishna, and that's the motivation. And also, that it's uninterrupted. In other words, it's not that I practice sometimes and other times I do something else that's disconnected. In other words, it's comprehensive. It's integrated into my entire lifestyle. Everything I do relates to that connection I have with the Supreme. And so these two are important. And there's ways in which one may manufacture different processes that are disconnected from the gold standard, or rather don't meet the gold standard. And these kinds of things are distinguished in the from the gold standard in the Bhagavatam. So I particularly picked on this sentence that the Vaishnav is not a member of a manufactured community of this material world. A Vaishnav is a real knower of the Vedas as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Vedaisya Sarver Ahameva Vedya, which brings us to the end of the purport. And just a note about one of the important points in the purport is Mahajano, the sense of there being an authorized person who is a source of knowledge. To the rebellious mind, this may sound like anathema that why should I listen to somebody else? I once met somebody in Santa Cruz. I was showing Bhagavad Gita on the street, offering it to people, and somebody started looking through it and he goes, I want the Bhagavad Gita. I don't want all these other commentaries in here. Just want the straight thing. And it wasn't because of, you know, he wanted a lighter book or something. He was actually against the idea that somebody else would comment, or that there was an authority, a teacher that would say, you know, this means this. And he said, I'll just... However, in any system of knowledge, there must be some point at which we accept authority. This is commonly known as dogma. And of course... most people take the word dogma in a pejorative sense. However, everybody accepts some dogma. If you take the science, if you're studying with the teacher, he or she is going to present you with a list of authorities in your particular science. And you're either going to accept those authorities or you're not going to be able to continue the class. Because that's the axiomatic truth that one must accept. And... as Socrates pointed out, at some point in any system of knowledge, unless you accept an axiomatic truth and a source of that axiomatic truth, then you're going to be in infinite regress. That means you'll have to continually retreat, like an army that keeps backing up. You have to stand and fight at some point. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes in his teachings that some knowledge is self-revealing. It proves itself. So you have to have that kind of knowledge. So this is one of the points that's coming up in this chapter, is that you have to accept axiomatic truth. So when we accept the Vedas, we accept Shastra, we understand through research or epistemological research of what it means to know something, and we understand that one has to accept from an authority. Then when we come to rest on that concept and appreciate the fact that the Vedas are teaching us something that is axiomatic, and we begin to accept it, then we can make great progress. And this is something that Prabhupada brings up in a summary form in the introduction to the Sri Ishapanishad, where he talks about this principle of epistemology. And now we'll take a few reflections of anything that you heard in the... Yes?
I like how...
Now the...
This is Mike. I'm just explaining this because this is broadcast online, and when we speak away from the mic, I have one right here on my lapel, so or whatever I have up here, that people can hear directly. But when it comes to the audience, unless you hold the microphone like this, it doesn't pick up, and they get really not just, you know, disturbed, but like annoyed in. Gopal will start getting all these comments that can't hear, tell them to talk louder. So you got to hold the mic right here. Don't be afraid to speak loudly into the mic. Please go ahead.
I like how Krishna...
It's good.
I like how Krishna states religion in the Bhagavad Gita. He He said religion is surrender unto him.
Yeah.
Compared to how heavy of a way we look at religion. And it's just straight up simple.
Yeah, so to give a simple example, my finger, I take it for granted, I admit.
But my finger, whenever I call it, it comes to me. Or if I say, finger, you know, go pick up that stamp. You know, it'll work together with the other fingers, of course, and cooperate, and it'll pick up the stamp and hand it to me. But if the finger, I call the finger, I say, finger, come here, and finger doesn't come, then I'm in a serious trouble. A lot more serious than I would have imagined, because I always take it for granted, but when it stops working. So, as the finger is a part and parcel of my body, so I am also a part and parcel of Krishna. And my relationship is as my finger is to my body. And therefore, when I'm out of alignment in service to Krishna, I'm in an unnatural condition. I can't actually enjoy. I can't, I'm not working properly. So this idea of religion really means to be properly aligned. And this verse where Krishna is saying, surrender unto me, Prabhupada sometimes says, people hear that and they say, that's unreasonable. Why should I surrender to God? But it's for our own good. And the fact that you appreciate it, I mean, this is a person who's coming to actual spiritual life and now available to be properly aligned, is that they look at that verse and they say, yeah, that sounds good. Surrender to God. The principle itself, surrender to God, is universally good. Thank you. There were a couple more. Yes.
I was thinking when you were talking and when you were reading these verses that in material life, or even bringing it into spiritual life, that we're quick to fault find in others. And especially, we can have distrust in following authorities because of experiences where they didn't live up to our expectations, or we saw some hypocrisy in them, that they were saying one thing but acting in a different way. So these verses were making me reflect that actually in Krishna consciousness we're given a different standard of perfection, that one who's following the process of Krishna consciousness, if they're doing that consciousness, if they're doing that perfectly, then actually they are perfect, we can follow them like that. And if I had that realization, then maybe I wouldn't be so prone to find fault in the devotees around me.
Nice point. And Krishna emphasizes this in the Gita, 9th chapter, where he says, api sutaracharo
padareva samantavya samyag vyavasito hisaha. And that is that if somebody is properly aligned, Krishna says, that is in their purpose of surrender, then even if they appear to be affected by worldliness, sudarachara means they did something that was off color. Actually, it means even more than that. I mean, it's even hard to say, but sudarachara means bad, and sudarachara, there's an emphasis on it, it's really bad. So Krishna is emphasizing here. He's using these words deliberately, and he's saying that even if somebody's in that situation where they really blow it, then if their intention is properly aligned, that I'm a servant of Krishna, I'm going to go on serving. Then in the next verse he says, Shripram bhavati dharmatma shashvas chantim nagachati kuntiya pratijani hi nami bhakti pranashati. Tells Arjuna that you say it loudly, boldly, that very soon my devotee will come to the perfectional stage. And going back to the previous verse, apichet sudaracharo, he says that the person that who's properly aligned, who does something that seems to be off color, must be considered saintly because they're properly situated. Also, if somebody is not up to the standard of having all good qualities, but is properly aligned, it's also mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam that if one continues the process of Krishna consciousness, goes on practicing, even though one's doing it imperfectly, or has fallen from the process and done something aberrant, vikarma, has gone against the process, fallen down, basically. Then it's a supada mulam, I don't know the verse number, supada mulam bhachata priyasya tanya bhavasa hare priyeshaha vikarma yachchot patitan katanchit dhunoti sarvam pridisani vishtaha. And in this verse, is mentioned that if a person goes on with the practice of Krishna consciousness, even though slipping from the process, Krishna knows within the heart that the person's sincere and will rectify the person's faults. It'll be properly rectified. You don't have to do anything extra other than go on with your service. And this will relate more and more to this section of the Bhagavatam about how one is rectified, because this is about rectification. How do you actually overcome sinful life, or even more importantly, how do you overcome the desire for sinful life within your heart, and what to do about it when you're implicated in sinful activity. Were there two more? Yes.
On many occasions, we're seeing living in these suffers, whatever your animal or human being, and like you said, the animals evolve from time until they become a human being. As the soul continues passes from different bodies, they have no recollection of whatever suffering or misery they're undergoing. And for me, I've asked this question many times, never got a proper answer to it, is that when the living entity suffer, it's like, for instance, I'll give an example will help you to understand. If a policeman comes and arrests you without telling you what you're being arrested for, and then you're prosecuted and have to serve a sentence, you will be wondering why. And every day we see living entity suffering, and nobody can remember their past life, what's the reason they're suffering for?
Yes, an important and very good question.
We should understand where the remembrance and the forgetfulness comes from. It comes from Krishna. As we know from the 15th chapter, 15th verse, Sarvasya chaham hridisani vishto matak smitir gyanam apohanam cha. So that first line of the Sanskrit verse says that Krishna says that I'm the source of remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness, right? So why would Krishna, who's all-powerful, he's within the heart, cause us to forget our sinful activities in the past? Well, one reason is that if we remembered them all, we would be tormented. And we wouldn't actually be able to live a normal life. And Krishna doesn't want that. He wants us to be able... Well, first of all, I'll say, I don't want that. As a living entity, I'm speaking. Not personally, but I'm just trying to represent the living entities here. Living entities don't like that kind of stuff. We want to have a normal life, and we want to enjoy, right? And so in order to enjoy in the material world, I really have to forget. So Krishna helps us to forget. I'm getting there. So this is we have to understand that Krishna is facilitating if I want to remember or I want to forget. It's coming from him. Now, as far as remembrance goes, there are different kinds of remembrance. The psychologists will tell us, hopefully, we have one here, that there are different ways of that we process memory. Some types of memory are emotional memories. For instance, you hear a particular piece of music, and it will stimulate you. I mean, you'll feel it viscerally when you hear that music because, oh, you were on a beach, you were a teenager, you were free, you just bought a pickup truck, you know, and you heard that song by the Carpenters or something. And it's like, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like you hear that song, it's like, oh, you know, I'm young again, you know. And this is a kind of memory. This is a kind of memory. And I can't catalog all the different kinds of memories, but psychologists have. And there are various kinds of memory rather than the kind where we employ a particular part of our brain and we say 2 + 2 = 4. I remembered that. And that's another kind of memory. There is a kind of memory that the living entities develop that's cumulative in their heart. The kinds and how's one of the poetical ways this is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, a living entity has suffered so much in the material world. One living entity has cried so much, life after life, that there's an ocean of tears accumulated from that. That begins to have an effect on the living entities where they start to feel that this material world is not my home. Especially when there are a confluence of circumstances, and that is, if one happens to come in contact with devotees and gets this very precious thing called Bhakti Unmukhi Sukriti, which begins to make them more aware of the fact that they're suffering in the material world. And they may not see it philosophically or remember a particular lifetime, but there's an overwhelming feeling that this isn't right. I'm not situated properly. For instance, in the Bhagavatam, there's a story of Gajendra. Gajendra's an elephant. He was a devotee in his last life, but he got cursed to be an elephant in his next life. And when he was cruising as an elephant. He was happy. He was the king of the elephants. He had a little intoxication going on. He was like, everyone got out of his way when he walked. Everyone likes that. You know, you're walking along, he's like, hey, they got out of my way. You know, Gajendra was enjoying. He was on a heavenly planet. He went into the water. And then he got crocodile on his leg. And now what did he do? He didn't exactly remember his past life as Indradyumna and say, oh, I remember all these prayers I chanted in my last life. All he knew was there was this piercing sense in his heart that I have to take shelter of somebody higher. He didn't even know who God was. But that was a kind of memory that he has in his heart. Every living entity has that. And when the circumstances are right, that memory comes out and one calls out, God, help me. There's no, as the old saying goes, atheists in foxholes. We remember that relationship when we're in danger, right? We're in danger, bullets are flying overhead, we could die at any second, what do? You know, we call, please help me. God, if you're there, if this just one time saved me, I'll be good from now on. This is a kind of natural memory that we have, that we're connected to a higher source. And so, this kind of memory, when it accumulates within the heart of the devotee, makes a person ripe for surrender to God. And when you ask the question then, who is it? Who's God? Just like Gajendra, he started praying. He didn't exactly know where the prayers were coming from, but he knew the feeling. That's a memory. And he started to say it. And from that, Krishna then started to reveal himself. You know, every parent in the world wants to have a relationship with their children. They don't have children and then hide themselves for the rest of their life and say, you know, I'm never going to reveal myself. That would be an insane situation. So God, who's the supreme parent, wants to reveal himself as much as possible, but it's been my choice to not to have him reveal himself. Don't interfere. I mean, even now as I'm practicing devotional service, what if Narayan appears and says, come back to my abode? I might say, I would, but I gotta work my late shift today. even as devotees, we may not have the full intention that we need yet to go back to God. In the interim, Krishna gives us a modicum of balance in our lives in the material world. I'll give you an example of that from another philosophical point of view, how Krishna offers living entities opportunity to express their free will in the material world. Because ultimately, bhakti is dependent on us choosing sarva dharma parityaja, I surrender completely, and I know what I'm doing. And Krishna, as we develop our intentionality, or intention, I'll just say, he gives us more and more remembrance of why we should do it, and so forth. But in this sixth canto, we'll find later on that there's this way in which by chanting the holy name, Ajamil was freed from sinful activities. However, he went on sinning. He chanted Hare Krishna, he chanted Narayan. Everyone say Narayan.
Narayan.
By doing that accidentally, as mentioned in this section of the Bhagavatam, that if you say it accidentally, say it for musical entertainment, if you say it derisively, like yesterday some guy was coming around and go, you Hare Krishnas, get out of here. And he's like, thank you for chanting. And you know, any way you say the holy name, it's Krishna, he's appearing there. So Ajamil chanted Narayan. He meant to call his son. And now all the acharyas agree. He was freed from sinful activities. But he went on sinning. So what's up with that? So our acharyas explain, as does Srila Prabhupada, who's bringing out the commentary of the acharyas, that the kind of sin that was going on at that point was like a snake who had been defanged. No teeth. He's biting, but nothing happening. Because he's already been saved by the power of the holy name, and now Ajamil, it was only a matter of time before his purification and full remembrance came to fruition. So after he hears this dialogue between the Yamadutas and Vishnudutas, he hears the whole thing, the whole philosophical dialogue, he comes to full remembrance, oh, this is what I did. This is who I am. This is what I need to do. So the circumstances lead to that fully. Now in the commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, why doesn't, the obvious question everybody had, why does that happen if everybody chants the holy names and it's so purifying, why doesn't everybody immediately become purified and on the topmost level? One of the reasons that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says is that Krishna doesn't give the full results of the chanting to everybody. First of all, because it's like a tree, it grows in due course of time when it's ready, a fruit on a tree. And the other reason is that he doesn't want to discourage people on other paths. For instance, people have chosen paths of jnana, karma, yoga, and so forth, and they have faith in it. And that's what they want to do. Now, if everybody in bhakti immediately got the result of chanting the holy name, then those people would become discouraged. And this is, I'm just painting a picture to show the extent to which Krishna goes to give a world that is fully free. Because if he doesn't give a world that's fully free for us to make that ultimate choice that I'm going to surrender, and if he doesn't give us forgetfulness of him, then we can't actually express ourselves fully in the material world without him around. We're like a person who's divorced somebody and said, look it, you know, don't send me any emails. You know, if you're going to send me checks in the mail, just deposit them in anonymously. I don't even want to know you. You know, the support is there, but it's like nothing to do with you at all. And that's been my position in the material world for so long. I wanted to forget. So Krishna is a little reticent about immediately coming in and saying, I'm back, you know, like I've been here all the time. He wants that mutual respect, love, and surrender from the living entity. So he gives the opportunity for us to forget. And then when we develop our intention, he gives us, in the right proportion, the kind of remembrance that will give us, that will empower us to fully surrender. And that's a day to celebrate. I mean, that's a moment, an instant. And it goes on eternally. The more we have that intention to surrender, the more we come closer to Krishna.
You transmigrate from one species to another until you become materially exhausted, and then gradually the Supreme Lord will restore his mercy, and then you'll remember.
Yeah, I could have just said that.
So we have about 5 more minutes, right?
Yes.
And, yes, Prabhu? We have time for one more. 5 minutes is an eternity.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
In the Srimad Bhagavatam 6.1.14, it says something about dharma. It says that dharma is not actually manifested by Narayana. And in the same standard, it's also said that it emits from the breathing of Narayana. Can you please explain me on this?
Yeah, the way in which it's described, that it's co-eternal with the Lord.
And Vishnu are both eternal, so they're co-eternals. And then, you know, it's described in this way, poetically, metaphorically, even that you know, it's emanating from the breathing of the Lord to show that there's no difference between the two, and that it's eternally going on. And then there are various levels, or as I was mentioning before, a hierarchy of dharmas, which in the Bhagavad Gita we get a sense of that. Like Arjuna was perfectly justified. He was mentioning certain kinds of levels of dharma when Krishna mentioned a higher dharma. But the ultimate dharma comes when one realizes that I'm an eternal servant of Krishna and one surrenders. So that, in a nutshell, is, you know, describes the context for those statements. But we have to go through all of the verses and hear the whole section in order to really reinforce those ideas and understand them very clearly. And this is a really nice assembly. I mean, what a word, nice. I'm very impressed by what you've developed here. This is the essence of spiritual life, is sitting in an assembly of devotees and discussing the Srimad Bhagavatam. And anyone who does this once, twice, or especially on a regular basis will naturally and automatically be elevated in the process of Krishna consciousness. As Navina Prabhu gave such a beautiful class this morning, he was describing how just by sitting and hearing submissively, one learns everything that's necessary to know to, in order to enact one's surrender. Kashtubha Prabhu, did you have a last point? Just that we have an extended hearing session today that starts up at 2:00.
Okay, wonderful. And
you didn't know about it?
I heard about it actually. Thank you for sharing it.
I hope
here.
It's okay.
There's that, and then after that, actually, 4:00, so just as that ends, we begin our picnic out in the park, in Roosevelt Park, Rockefeller Park, downtown. Wow. So that's just we do about once a month during the summer. This will be the last one for the season. So please, everyone, come for this extended hearing, and then afterward, make your way downtown, and we'll all be together in the park down there. Thank you so much for coming. And anything that's here is
no place I'd rather be. And just again, the level of attendance and concentration here is indicative of this community.
You helped the attendance, by the way. but hopefully, everybody that's come today will please continue to come. Because, you know, we felt here that, for instance, our Thursday night kirtan is a well-attended event. We get 150, 200 people sometimes coming to that, just regularly every week. And we've gradually developed a mood and an excitement and a taste for kirtan here. And we want to see going right alongside the same type of enthusiasm and eagerness to hear Shastra. And then then our chanting will mean so much more to us.
Really nice, Kashtubha Prabhu. One develops we say taste, also.
To sit and hear and chant. And it's based on taste, really. But it is an acquired taste. And the more one does it, the more one is eager to hear, and longer sessions of time one can hear for, which is highly beneficial. I mentioned before, in Govardhan, we have sessions at the Govardhan Hill Ashram every year, where we have a group of devotees, and we sit like this for 5 hours a day, and hear through the whole Kartik. And we notice sometimes people come in from a different environment. You know, like over at Krishna Balaram Mandir, it's like roller derby, you know. And, you know, there's a lot going on over there. It's like, wow! And you come over to Govardhan, it's sequestered, and we're just hearing, you know, sitting in it. It's more cerebral. And people come in the environment, and you see them like, when's lunch? And then, you know, it's like, I gotta go. I think my mother's calling me, you know. And they take off. So, but after some time, you know, you can develop this kind of tolerance, a taste for hearing, and it's really important. So, just wonderful what you're doing.
It expands so much from you. And I just wanted to mention, you drew our attention to a period from Srila Prabhupada, where, I forget, it was from the fourth canto, but it Prabhupada spoke so beautifully there about how what we speak, on one hand, it has to be really firmly rooted in authority, in Shastric authority, and the original purpose, the text, must be maintained. But at the same time, and one as well, one shouldn't screw out obscure meaning. But at the same time, it also must be presented in a manner that's understandable by the audience. And it seems that we live in a world where maybe more than ever, conservative and progressive ideas are polarized. We see it in politically and in people's attitudes. But I think also within the community of devotees, I see it. We tend to become polarized. Maybe, I don't know if it's just me seeing it that way, or if maybe somehow it is like that more. But I think it's really worth looking at this commentary and thinking, you know, if someone's presentation of Krishna consciousness is more, let's say, progressive, they might have to question themselves. Am I losing the original purpose of what I'm trying to present? And if someone's presentation is more conservative, they might have to ask themselves, am I really communicating with people clearly? And maybe even, you know, both, not only question how we, our own selves, but question our own criticism of others as well. Because what's worst of all is that actually all the devotees start to fight with each other. Because then nothing's accomplished. It's particularly unpleasing to Krishna. But I really respect you so much, and I see you, again, I mentioned it, I'll use the same cliche, but I see you as a real shining example of one who understands this very well and lives it very well and presents it very well. That I really see in you someone that all of your words, all of your actions are so completely in line with the truth as it's originally presented in our Shastra and by our Acharyas. But at the same time, you have a really wonderful way of really trying to understand your audience and what will help them understand and enliven and without judgment, but with just clarity. So it's really what we try to base the Bhakti Center on, this balance between firmly rooted and branching out. Mm-hmm. And your example of it is really essential for us. We see it a lot in Radha Swami. We kind of try to imbibe it from him and yourself as well. It's very important for us to have devotees like you in our community. And so please come back more often.
As they say in Japan, kuchiro koso, right back at you. And, as far as coming back, my mama didn't raise no fool.
I don't know which side of the bread is the butter, and it's here, so I look forward to seeing you again and again. Not the least of which is at 2:00 when we start up again. If you'd like to come back, because we will try extending a little more and seeing how it sits, since we have the opportunity. At least I do, anyway.
Thank you. And speaking of bread and butter, we'll have kirtan, and then after that, we'll have a prasad.
Okay.
But hopefully, everyone can stay, and we're encouraging people. Sometimes when we have this our shastra, and then as soon as it ends, people start to disperse, and the conversations start. But really, again, the shastra is really meant to help us understand the importance and the taste for the kirtan. So as we have RT and we have kirtan, everyone please stay and really fully invest your minds and your hearts in the kirtan. And we ask if you can leave the kirtan first. Okay, it's a crime too. Thank you all so much.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman. Hey, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.